everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series on conversations with remarkable minds, we're going to look at the wisdom of the forest in the time of rapid climate change and what we need to learn from nature in order to counter human greed and hubris. My guest from Marysville, Ontario, Canada, is Diana Birchford Kroger. If Jane Goodall is the ambassador for the animal kingdom and Vandana Shiva is the ambassador for seeds, then Diane is unquestionably the global ambassador speaking on behalf of the world's trees and forest. And perhaps no one possesses the wisdom of the forest as Diana, an Irish-Canadian researcher, botanical scientist, medical biochemist, and nature mystic. She's written extensively on the molecular biology of trees and their medicinal properties and trees' social interactions in the forest and with other life forms and forest conservation and the traditional wisdom trees hold for healing. In the past, Diana has held science posts at the Canadian Department of Agriculture and the University of Ottawa School of Medicine. She is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and she was named a World Visionary by Utney Reader. Her research gardens outside of Ottawa, open to the public, include rare plants from Turkey, Iran, China, and 100 rare types of trees from the northern forests in other countries, many that are endangered. Her latest book is The Sweetness of a Simple Life, and a documentary about Diana's work across many nations exploring the secrets of northern forest. The Call of the Forest, The Forgotten Wisdom of Trees, was recently released across Canada. More about her work can be found at calloftheforest.ca. Nice to have you with us today, Diana.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's lovely to hear your voice again.
Thank you. Recently, meaning in the last year,
yes,
I've completed a major documentary on saving the planet.
Oh, really?
And it started as a simpler project almost 9 years ago.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
everywhere I looked, there were crises. And what I saw was there was two views of it. A, it was not a big deal, not human-made. Or B, yes, it was a problem, but nothing we had to be concerned with in our lifetimes. It'd be 100, 200 years before it got bad enough to deserve real attention. And then I started seeing that we went from about 7 major tipping points to 12 to 20, and now we're over 40 tipping points with feedback loops that interreact one to another. And one of those that is important involves the melting of the permafrost across the northern hemispheres, where the great boreal forests exist in Norway, in Canada, in Russia, and other Scandinavian countries that historically we've never thought about because they've always been frozen. We go there in the wintertime to appreciate the ambiance, and we go there in the summertime to go up into the sweet grass valleys to see how these places exist in our appreciation. Now we got another problem. Billions of these methane tubes are releasing gas into the atmosphere, methane gas. Under the Great Arctic, they're doing that. Now, this does not directly relate to you. I'm merely giving you where we have come from and why this...
It does relate.
Why it's so important today. And now, I've interviewed 15 climatologists, including Professor Guy McPherson and others, who all say that the world as we know it will begin to go through cataclysmic feedback loops within 10 years.
Maybe even sooner,
And that the idea that we don't have to do anything, because we haven't, the United States government, the British government, the German government, these major governments of the world, including the Canadian government, have not only not done anything, but they've continued to rely upon fossil fuels extraction. And as a result, this year we saw the worst earthquake in Kansas, the state in the United States history. It's 4.9. And it, the National Geographic Society, or the Geological Society, said it was the earthquake due to gas hydrofracking. They put 5,000 gas hydrofracking wells in Kansas in 1 year. Oklahoma is now the earthquake center of America with over 5,000 earthquakes per year, and they're getting stronger. And now we're starting to see the great kill-off, over 100 million trees in California.
Yeah,
the heat, heat is causing infestations of beetles. The plants' immune systems are being challenged. We have no major conservation system right now except for culling the trees, which has given an excuse to both the Obama and now the Trump administration to open up these great forests for cutting down.
Yeah.
But if you ask the average person, what are you personally doing about global warming? What do you know about global warming? They'll say, well, we had some hot days and rainy days, and that's about the extent of their knowledge. So bearing this in mind now, after all these years, I'm looking at feedback loops that are going to cause once in 500-year events to happen yearly. We had seven in the United States this year, including the massive flooding in Louisiana, where the entire state was devastated. And the news didn't focus on it. There's no insurance. It was one of those events people were not prepared for. It came and went. And there'll be more. So that's my background. Now, on the other hand, I'm an optimist. I believe we can always find some solutions for everything if we look. But it depends upon where we look, who's doing the looking, and how broad is their vision, how deep is their understanding of the problem. And I find no one, I mean zero, in the main Orthodox scientific community who has the courage to come forward and tell us the absolute truth. Instead, they're all giving us politically correct statements. Well, it's not that bad. Well, we have time. And there's a whole nother group, a smaller group of scientists saying, we don't have any time. Time's up. You know, we're out of time. Not that life's going to end, but we're losing 200 species per 24 hours. Every 24 hours, 200 species on the Earth end. And now the orangutans, because of the deforestation over there and all the trees being cut down, they're dying. And so you have been all over the world. You've seen this. You know how far we have come in our self-destruction and our denial of that. And so I'd first like to have you give us an overall look at the world we live in through your eyes, and then tell us what are the lessons we have yet to accept, learn, and let alone do nothing about. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. Thank you. Your introduction is a little depressing for a lot of people. Now, it shouldn't be, because I'll tell you why. Only 2% of the population are educated in science, okay? And of that percentile, I know you have your biochemistry around your belt, and I do too, and organic chemistry, nuclear chemistry, and all the other stuff that I have. So I've got that stuffed in my belt, and I represent a very small percentile of academics in some ways, because I believe in a multidisciplinary approach, and the universities haven't thought of that yet. So for the general public, I say, don't worry too much. Now, I'll tell you why you shouldn't worry too much. Because there are people like me on the planet, and I can't get fired. So I can give you a very general opinion, and that's my opinion, and it's an opinion that crosses the boundaries of medicine into the sciences, into quantum physics, into the biological situation, and I'll describe what I have seen all across the planet in doing this film, Call of the Forest, The Forgotten Wisdom of Trees. First of all, the forests are coming down, and we have cut down too many forests. We have cut down too many trees all across the planet. Now, 2,000 years ago, your people and my people in the Celtic culture had a greater protection for the forests and the trees than we do now. And under the law system of the ancient Celts, now a lot of you are Irish, just like me, or you've got a dribble of Irish in your veins, just like me, and just like actually Obama was an eighth cousin Irish in Northern Ireland. We had a set of laws called the Brehon Laws, B-R-E-H-O-N, Brehon Laws, where things were in common. They had the commonage. The land was in commonage. The sky was in commonage. Water was in commonage. That meant that all of us, and medicines too, all of us owned these things in common. There was a greater sharing and bartering on the planet. And there were not people who were extraordinarily rich, like Nero, and I can't mention a few names down in the States, who have billions of dollars, but they're not sharing their money. So that wasn't the case 2,000 years ago. And together with that, there was the laws of the trees. These laws were extraordinary, and they put an eyeball, a lens on the trees, and from that they developed the second greatest alphabet in the world after Sanskrit, and it was called the Ogham script. And that script was a description of the trees with a philosophy that dangled with that script. And that is what made all of the world at the time a most precious place, where nature was indeed thought of as being sacred. And the idea was that the trees were the pillars of the planet. And since then, in all of science, all of us who are in the academic world know that the trees indeed form the sun. The quantum mechanics from the sun, in the presence of carbon dioxide and the presence of a little bit of moisture, can crack carbon dioxide open into carbon and oxygen. Oxygen feeds into the atmosphere, and carbon goes into the wood of the trees. It builds from nothing except the sun and a little bit of carbon dioxide. You get what you are breathing right now as you're listening to me. So I'm telling you, stop breathing, maybe for a half an hour or maybe for an hour. And if you can't breathe, or if you can breathe, thank the tree. That's what's happening in the whole planet. Trees are green machines. They are molecular machines. And Gary knows this as well as I do. They're extraordinary species, and we really don't understand them, and we're cutting them all down. And they are the species that have had the harmony of the skies, the harmony of the waters, the harmony of the oceans, and we never knew it until just recently. So what we have done is cut down too many trees. We don't have molecular machines anymore to pump out oxygen into the atmosphere and to collect and sequester, that's what we call in the ivory tower, sequester carbon dioxide out of the air into the trees. And that's climate change. It's that simple. So my simple solution is to you is look after the forests we already have. And indeed, actually, the United States of America has Alaska. And Alaska has the boreal forest that Barry was just talking about. The boreal forest is the crown on the planet. It's the full working forest on the planet and represents 30% of all of the forests on the planet. And it is an extraordinary forest, and it sweeps the air clean. And so that is only the only reason why we have climate change. Oh, there are some other reasons too. Too much diesel in the air, too much benzene in the air, so on and so forth. But we're not going to stop using our cars. We're going to go turn maybe to electric cars, maybe quantum cars. Oh, there are all kinds of solutions out there. And indeed, you know, SpaceX has got a whole pile of these solutions. And we've got some really smart kids coming on the market with some even better ideas on photo generation in quantum mechanics. So, you know, there are some fabulous things coming on the market right now. So what we have to do at the moment to stop the quandary we have in the world is just to plant more trees, plant native to native, and really protect the forests we have. So in the film that I've just done, Call of the Forest, The Forgotten Wisdom of Trees, and I do talk about all kinds of Irish things in this, and all of the prophecies of the time of now, all kinds of really neat, interesting things. Together with that, I've put together an app, and it covers all of the transplanting of all of the species of North America, north, south, east, and west, keyed into the medicine of the forest. Now, Gary is right, because now I'm coming into my own. The forests produce extraordinary medicines. There are certain trees that you can plant that will protect your immune system against cancers. There are all kinds of interesting trees, trees that will protect you against virus infections. So, you know, you can select your trees around your house, pop them in, and look after them, and then look after the quality of the forest. That's all you have to do. Very simple. And the film is really beautiful. And the only problem I had with the film was when I was in Japan, oh my goodness, I was presented as an honored guest a plate of eyes, of tuna fish eyes, all rolling around on the plate. And I have to tell you something. I looked at those eyes as they rolled around and glanced up at me, and I couldn't eat them. So I'm a total disgrace to the Irish nation, because I didn't eat them, and I had to put them away, and I pretended that I had an allergy to eyes. So... So there are better, braver souls than me out there, I know.
Diana, in a few moments, I'd like you to talk about some of the trees. For example, the philodendron tree has specific chemicals that bring down cortisol levels, which mm-hmm. is our stress hormone, therefore can help us de-stress. But in any mm-hmm. case, your life's work has been to personalize the forest yeah. and the life and even consciousness of trees for mm-hmm. humanity. But the wisdom you have acquired goes beyond you being a botanist and biochemist. It has more to do with how indigenous cultures who live in harmony with nature create a kind of sensual, co-independent relationship with their environment that goes beyond simple science and data collection. Yeah. So I'd like you to share with us, when you were orphaned as a small child and told that you were the last child of an ancient Ireland, yeah. and you were instructed that it was your purpose in life to bring the perfume of this ancient knowledge mm-hmm. to our very troubled planet. So mm-hmm. share with us a little bit about your background and okay. how it led to your journey to become a scientist and ultimately to study the boreal forest throughout the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
And you can draw a distinction between what you might call or having an intimate relationship with trees that unveils a certain wisdom compared to simply gaining scientific knowledge of trees, which is the standard mode of learning in Western civilization. And finally, what are the consequences of humanity having lost its relationship with the forest due to our alienation from our natural home? And how has this broken relationship been contributing to climate change and global warming? Please continue. Oh, by the way, my ancestry is also Irish.
Ah, okay. Oh, really? Ah, well, that's your problem and my problem, isn't it, really?
Yes.
I knew there was a Celt right buried in there somewhere. Well, I come from a very ancient family in Ireland. Ireland is divided into five counties, and my county, Coigamuna, in Gaelic they're called, because I speak fluent Gaelic, in the county of Munster. And Munster is the southern area of Ireland. And my family castle is the Castle of Ross. And I am the last person with the greatest brehunus. I have the greatest pedigree of probably most anybody alive now on the planet. And my pedigree goes back about 1,500 years. So I'm the last child of the kings of Munster. And when my family was killed in a car crash when I was, very young, I was considered to be a very precious child because I was the last child left. And by the way, in the Celtic culture, inheritance goes through the female line. The female line is considered to be the more important line than the male line, as a matter of fact. And so my mother's relatives, and that the castle is the Castle of Ross. You can look it up on the internet, and it's on the lower lake of Killarney. And we had been the educators of the High King, the Ardrí, the High King up in Tara in Ireland for thousands of years, really. And what happened is my mother's relatives really came out of the mountains, out of the Caha Mountains, and they took me under Abraham wardship. Those are the ancient Gaelic laws. And in the Breton wardship, I was taken for 3 years up into the mountains and into all kinds of areas in Ireland. And I was taught the old learning of the Druids, the medicines, the ancient medicines of the old time, the thinking of an Peshoegris. And an Peshoegris in Gaelic are linked to a form of magic, but they're also linked to a form of telepathy, of holding silence in your mind, just like in Buddhism. And I was taught the laws of the trees. All of these things, it took 3 years. And then I was put into the wardship of the courts. And the courts, on my father's side, my father was, family was the Earl of Tyrone and Lord Waterford. So I come from pedigrees on my father's side also. And when the judge was doing his indictment on me in some ways, he was very scared to put me into a laundry school because I was an orphan now, remember, and I should have been put into the Magdalen laundry and I should have been washing clothes for all of the people of the city of Cork, like all of the other kids like me. And he was really afraid to do that because he was afraid that because of my aristocratic background, and really I'm an aristocratic mongrel, really, that's the way to look at me. And he was afraid that my father's family might rear their heads because they were all admirals and viceroys and so on and so forth, and my mother's family too. So he swept me under the rug of the Breton laws, and he gave me the choice of living with a bachelor uncle. And I was a child at the time. My uncle had never married. He was a scholar. He was a scholar of all kinds of things. And I was given to my uncle as a child, adopted into that system. And he was the one, he and I were the ones, I lived with books. His house was full of books. He had 10,000 first edition books in the house. So we had a wonderful time reading books. And that was really the beginning of things. But when they were finished, the Breton wardship, when all of my 80 and 90-year-old cousins were finished the Breton wardship, they told me something really extraordinary. And I really didn't quite believe it then, to be perfectly honest with you. They told me that I would be their last child. In Breton laws, an orphan child is everybody's child. They all have ownership on me. And they told me I would be their last child and there would be no more children after me and that I would be the last voice of the ancient Gaelic world. Again, there would be no more after me. And I was given the sacred trust of taking the ancient knowledge that they had given me about telepathy, about silence, about movement into nature. I was to take that, I was to study, and I was to study as widely as I possibly could. And I was to take all that knowledge and bring it into the new world, because the new world would need it at the time that I would be active. And I never, ever, ever thought that those words were true. And today, you know, Gary, I know they're true. Because as you're saying, species are disappearing daily. And people are really not terribly happy. They are moving away from nature. They have commodified nature. They have put a dollar value on nature. They've put bottom line thinking on nature. How can you do that? How can you put a bottom line money value on love? How can you do that? You can't. You simply cannot. So nature is part of us, and we are part of nature. And all of the things I have in the film and all of the things that I write about what I was asked to write about. And it is a sacred trust from the ancient world of an Yelpa.
Well, thank you, Diana. We didn't know that, and it's a very unusual background, very eclectic background. For the average person listening right now, it may be somewhat challenging for them to perceive trees, let alone a collective forest, as being sentient. Interestingly, the Middle Eastern prophet of sorts, Mani, who was the founder of the second century religion, Manichaeism, had his revelation by hearing the emotional screams of yeast and bread being baked in the ovens. And the religion of Zarathustra, which was a precursor to Temple Judaism and Christianity, had a highly evolved respect for the sentience permeating the natural world that is similar to indigenous peoples today.
Yeah.
We have scientific findings, many originating from your own research, that reveals the intelligence of trees and plants, or photointelligence, that is analogous to the characteristics we endow humans. So how would you convince someone about the sentient qualities and awareness of a tree?
Well, I would ask every single one of my listeners to do this. If sometime in your life you are a little depressed, okay, you take a walk by the river, and the river, a river, any river, and the river should be flowing, and if you come across a willow tree, any kind of willow tree, and I would ask you to sit by the bank of the river in the presence of a willow tree, and I would ask you to do forest bathing in the presence of that willow tree. And the willow produces many, many forms of salicylic acid, and to you that is equivalent to aspirin. About 22 different forms, aldehydes, all different kinds, into the atmosphere and into the water. Stay there for 15 minutes. Straighten up your back. Breathe deeply so that you're breathing with your diaphragm, and get that good solution of salicylates into your body. Breathe and relax. And as you're doing that, your cortisol levels go down. It means that you're in full relaxation. And I would ask you to meditate into zero, into nothing, or meditate into some happy place or happy thing that has happened to you. And you will find at the end of 15 minutes that your depression has gone, or that your loneliness or bereavement has gone. Now, after that, I want you to think about something. The DNA in your body, everybody knows about DNA, and everybody knows that it's in a helical form. DNA really, in some ways, is a witness of the divine. And that is what the ancient peoples were aware of. They were aware of this by observation. But now, in the last very short while, in academia, in the world of science, we know that there is a DNA in all trees, and it is almost equivalent to your DNA, with the exception of what's known as two small bases on that DNA. You and the tree are almost identical. And in fact, if you and I were in a biochemical argument, the tree is almost superior to you because it can produce so many more compounds. It is truly a biochemical furnace, and that's what you're sitting next to. Now we know that. Now we know that most of the medicines, 60% of the medicines on the planet, come from trees, things like taxane, taxopherols. So you can look at a tree and be aware of what the tree is doing for you by way of a handshake. Let's think about this. You are breathing out carbon dioxide, and the tree breathes it in. You require oxygen, and the tree is supplying it. In the case of the willow, you are a little depressed because you're low and you don't feel so great, and maybe you've had a bad love affair, or God knows what. The tree will satisfy those feelings in you. And then you look at the green of the tree. Again, your cortisol goes down. And think in terms of the silence within the tree, or the silence within any forest, or the cathedral of any forest. And the forest will walk to you, walk in you, and walk through you. And you will find that you are more elevated as a human being. Just go do that experiment.
Thank you. I often look at a guest as a wonderful opportunity through whose eyes we can see the countries and how they critique the events and conditions happening in the United States. Now, you're Irish, you're Canadian, and you've certainly been observing the regressive efforts by the Trump White House to destroy whatever environmental, ecological, and conservation protections that may stand between the greed of private interest and any chance to tackle the challenges of climate change and restoring a natural environment. In fact, under Trump, we're taking giant steps at a cheetah's pace backwards from where we should be headed. How dangerous are Trump's policies to tear down more forest, remove regulations that might protect land from toxic pollution, withdraw the U.S. from climate agreements, and deny climate change outright? And how does the current administration and its minions represent what I consider the worst aspects of human hubris as the so-called superior creature that rules over the planet?
Well, there are two answers, two of Diana's answers to that one. First of all, and I really seriously mean this, we mean it not just for the Americans, because the Americans are the leaders in the world, let's face it. I mean, you've got some brilliant people there. Not some brilliant people, you've got a heck of a pile of brilliant people there. We need to have a discussion about greed. The moneylenders are in the temple. All of us know that. So we need a discussion about greed. We need a discussion about equity. And it is not good enough for me to have the poor so terribly poor. That's number one. Number two, my attitude to what is happening in the United States is a little frightening for me. I'm just a timid little woman, really. That's all I am. But I look at it from another point of view. I think that it is wonderful what he's doing, because what he's doing is exposing the belly of people. And what is happening, they're going to find the things that are going to happen to them. They're going to start thinking about the environment. They're going to start thinking about the rape of the environment. They're going to start thinking about the jobs that will not come. They're going to think about the quality of life they have. And they're going to think about all of the great things that the United States has done, and they will not be repeated. And it is a shame for the rest of the world. We look at what's happening with great fear in our hearts, and I can speak for everybody that I've talked to all across the world. But I think what's going to happen is a wake-up call. People are going to start thinking, and then people are going to remember they have the ability to vote, and they will vote well the next time.
Our century is already being defined by a constant, never-ending quest for human new technological solutions to tackle the problems created by the previous human technological solutions. The industrial civilization and capitalism has opened us to the Anthropocene age, but now we believe it will be geoengineering or more nuclear power plants that will save us. And there are huge investments and untold profits to be made by placing our faith into the knowledge of humanity's ingenuity rather than the wisdom of nature and what nature is telling us. So speak a little more about the institutions of science that are now failing us and further perpetrating the problems being brought about by climate change and environmental destruction.
Well, geoengineering is a global experiment, and really it's genocide. Because what it is the people who are doing this, the majority of them don't care about human life. And they know that so many people will die under the geoengineering propositions that are going out there right now. And that goes for many, many other arenas. They really don't care, so long as they make money. But the ordinary people, the people like you and me, we have to care. Because we do not know enough. There is not enough knowledge in the world to do any form of geoengineering right now. We do know that a butterfly on one part of the world in the chaos theory can produce real chaos right here at home. We do know that. And then, what was your other question?
No, you actually answered both. Thank you.
Yeah.
You noted that even foreign ambassadors to Canada are becoming aware of the urgent need to restore our global forest. Now, I've seen in the last 2 years in different countries, Nepal, in India, in Pakistan, Bhutan, I've seen that people are planting hundreds of thousands, even millions of trees. These are not the government doing it. These are citizens doing it. And they're doing it with such a reverence, not just for now, but for future generations. And the American media doesn't give a single line of type or a single moment for us to know this. Could you talk about what people are doing around the world that shows that they care and they're actually part of the solution?
They are part of the solution, and in Bhutan, they are carbon negative. There's so many trees planted in Bhutan, and the people are behaving in such a simplistic way. The sweetness of a simple life comes from that, comes from the Dalai Lama, that kind of thinking. That's how they're living their life, and they're carbon negative. So we do not have enough riches in the world to throw them all away. We don't have that. So in different countries, in different places, they're putting in dowry trees. They're putting in trees so that the girlies, when they get married, will have money in their pockets so they can conduct a good life. In Germany, they're doing designs on trees so as to withstand climate change, so as to withstand the excessive moisture that is in snow and is in rain, horrendous rainfalls that are due to happen and have been happening. They're designing, redesigning certain stands of trees to withstand that. In other countries, in England, they're putting in 2-acre forests. They're protecting their forests. In Ireland, I'm behind, scientifically behind, replanting the great woods of Ochtie, the great woods of the last High King of Ireland. Now, Canada is remiss and the United States is remiss because everything has a dollar value. And no, not everything does have a dollar value. You should look out over your borders. This goes for Canadians and it goes for Americans to look to other places and to see what great things they're doing. And you're right, Gary, they are doing these things with great reverence. They are planting the trees with great reverence because they know that the trees are the salvation of the planet. In the ancient times, the forests were called the mantle of the poor.
There is a very poor man in India who decades ago decided to devote his life to reforestation, planting trees. He had no means, but he had desire, and he had motivation, and he had spiritual grounding. Today, he has taken an area that was deforested, and it's 1,200 acres. I do not know how many trees he has planted in that, but I would imagine be over 60,000 trees. He did it himself, one person. Yeah. Now, back during the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had what was called the CCC, the Civil Conservation Commission. He would go into a community, the federal government would, and hire people who lived there who were otherwise poor to plant trees and hedgerows. And we had not learned a lesson because of the great soil erosion. We were not respecting the crops that were diverse. Instead, we were monotheistic in one crop, whether it was wheat or corn. We wouldn't grow anything else. And then in the wintertime, we wouldn't grow a cover crop. As a result, the snow and rain would crack the ground in huge amounts, as much as a ton per acre would run off and go into the Mississippi. Today, at the base of the Mississippi, you have the consequences of not having a mine for conservation. You have the largest dead zone in the world. It's larger than the state of New Jersey. I went down there to film it for my documentary, and nothing lives in it that requires oxygen because there is no oxygen, and we have over 400 of these dead zones, and yet there are places, Bhutan you were referring to, and also in Africa, small villages are redoing sustainable agriculture using natural systems, not pesticides, not nitrogen-based fertilizers, not genetically engineered seeds. And in India, at the base of the Himalayas, Vandana Shiva is doing a magnificent job of planting thousands of variety of different food to to bring them back. There were 1,200 different types of papaya alone, we're down to two or three. So talk about what you're seeing individuals do and what we need to do in Canada and the United States today.
Well, let's talk to people in houses and let's talk to the urban people. You can look after your forests. And by the way, Roosevelt, who was the most wonderful man, I think, he was an extraordinary person. Let's go back to him for a minute. The species that he planted were called Gleditsia triacanthos, honey locusts. And America had a terrible, terrible time, terrible drought, and you lost lots and lots of your topsoil, and there was starvation. People had enormous unemployment numbers. They were rolling unemployment, really, really poor people. It was just a shocking situation. And Roosevelt ordered millions and millions of these Gleditsia trees to be put in. But as well as that, he did another extraordinary thing. What he did is he had breeding, and this is genetic breeding, cross hybrid ordinary breeding of these Gleditsia triacanthos to produce seed pods on these trees that had super high amounts of sugar in them. And these were used to feed cattle. They were used to do all kinds of things. And in fact, they also made a very high quality bread, which made people much slimmer. It was not a fattening kind of bread. So he did all kinds of really marvelous things. And actually, I think we can do this again. It would be so exciting to do this again. But, you know, what you're talking about is what Vandana Shiva is doing. She's trying to bring biodiversity back. She's trying to do what E.O. Wilson in Harvard, you have a great treasure in Harvard, E.O. Wilson, Professor E.O. Wilson, who coined the word biodiversity. She's trying to bring that back. And indeed, I am too. So, between all of us, we can do a great deal across the planet. And I think it'll be tremendously exciting to do this. For me, personally, putting in the great woods of Opti, we've got loads and loads of Irish farmers agreeing to do this, to put in Brian Boru's tree. And that is the Quercus robur, the great, great Quercus, the great oak of Ireland. And people can eat these acorns. These are anti-famine trees. I mean, this is really, really exciting to do. And it is the only thing we have on the planet, in a way. We have nature. And nature is always twisting and turning and showing us and teaching us. It is the greatest teacher in the world for all of us, as a matter of fact, if we were to look at it. Now, I mean, you can't commodify nature, and this is what's happening. What's the value of an ecosystem? What's the value of a forest? What's the value of your daughter's life? What's the value of your son's life? Sorry, baby, they have no value. These are beyond value. These things are bound with boundless love. We love the birds that come in. We love nature around us. I mean, fresh water. Who of us can do without fresh water? So if you don't have forests, you will not have fresh water. So it is to value the great things that we have around us by way of nature. And there are a few people on the planet doing extraordinary things. But we are increasing in our numbers of people who are following us. We are increasing in what we are doing. And it is going to be absolutely magnificent.
I agree. I don't know if there's a real solution for the trajectory of humanity, that the way it's headed. I'm talking about the majority of people. Mm-hmm. An early 20th century Sufi teacher once replied, after being asked whether he was an optimist or pessimist, he said, "I'm an optimist, but an optimist with opened eyes. And to be an optimist with closed eyes is very dangerous." And a lot of people today are very flippant. If I ask them just innocent questions, tell me what you know that you as an individual could do to help lessen global problems. They would say nothing. I don't know. I would say if you stopped eating animals of any kind or anything comes from an animal, that represents 18% of the methane gas going into the atmosphere. And methane is not equal to carbon dioxide. It's many times greater in its intensity to create global warming. In fact, if in 1 year we stopped eating animals, and we have 80 billion animals on the planet right now that we're raising to eat, that would be more carbon that we would save than if all planes, trains, buses, and cars were not driven. So at some point, we have to bring this right down to the local level. All efforts start with someone. Every war in history started with one mind.
Yeah.
Every peace started with one mind. Every great idea started with one mind, to which you then collect other people to support you, either the high end or low end of that expectation and outcome.
Yeah.
So talk now, if you would, about what I believe is the optimistic but open-eyed optimistic of not just living today as if no other day counted, consuming massive amounts of things we don't need that drain the planet, but not willing to look at the consequences of what we're doing. It was Fritz Perl, the father of Gestalt psychology, who said a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. And I believe many people would do if they overcame their fear of what they had done and its consequences. Yeah. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Gary, I'm a pilgrim of hope. And I am also a pilgrim of peace. That is the underlying statement about me. Then I see the younger generation of their 20s and going into their 30s are extraordinary kids. They're extraordinary people. They are not so closely tied to money. They are more closely tied to nature. And they are really, truly extraordinary. I gave a lecture down in the Commons in New York, and I packed the place with professionals, with young professionals. They were extraordinary kids. And I have done workshops in Tokyo. They are extraordinary kids, multidiscipline, engineers, backgrounds of people. They are extraordinary. All across the world, I've done things like that. And I find that the younger generation, whatever is in their souls, they are able to do things differently. And they do understand the meaning of clean food. And they want to have clean food in their body. And they're prepared to do a lot for that. And indeed, a lot of them are vegetarians. And I do think now there is another answer to what you're saying. Increased methane in the atmosphere. If you have an ancient forest system, and if you look at the boreal forest system, there are many, many, many species of lichens in the ancient forests and in the boreal forest. They line the ground. They carpet the ground and carpet the trees. These species absorb methane. They are drunk on methane. They use methane like the trees use carbon dioxide. And the ancient forest did balance the methane once upon a time. And I think what is happening is that we are taking down forests to make so-called pasture land for so-called cattle that are poorly maintained on poorly maintained crop fodder. And the food from that is not as good as the bush food and is not as good a high-quality food as the organic food you get in hand. My taking is to have a tiny little bit of meat and a large amount of vegetables. Then you are not large anymore or fat anymore. You feel good and your brain is working. So I think a lot of these young people are discovering this all by themselves.
I appreciate the answer. I'm a vegan, so I have a little different perspective. We share just a little difference there. I believe all animals are sacred, therefore I don't want to ever have to, will not consume them. But on vegetables and fruits, yes. Mm-hmm. This past week, in fact, for the past 2 weeks, I have been at an intensive retreat. Mm-hmm. I work during these retreats, about 120 hours a week.
Yeah.
And
when
people come, I tell them all in the orientation, the most powerful experience you can have here, that which will liberate your innate healing capacity, is not the workshop leaders or the counselors or the lectures, yoga, meditation, the juices, the natural vegan diet. It's nature.
Yes.
To be able to quiet the mind, to sit beside a tree or in a clump of trees, that is where healing comes into play. And when you come from the suburbs that are sterile more often than not, and when you come from the cities that you can forget your humanity sometimes, yeah, living too long in steel and concrete, the rush of humanity, mm-hmm, indifferently passing you.
Yeah.
I said, imagine now that you have no stress. Mm-hmm. Trees talk with each other. Mm-hmm. And it's for us to realize that reality supersedes always scientific discovery. So the fact, yeah, that you haven't read it in a peer-reviewed literature that trees communicate is only because we have not yet been wise enough to understand their message. But at least now science is acknowledging trees actually communicate.
Yeah.
So imagine what would happen if you're sitting under that tree or with that tree, mm-hmm, and the tree knows intuitively, knows what you need, and starts to give you what you need in ways that you have never experienced. And I said, recently there was a study, and they found that a wolf preserve, where you have real wild wolves, mm-hmm, people with post-traumatic stress disorder, mainly ex-soldiers, go there, and each wolf will go over to one of these soldiers and befriend them while they're there. Mm-hmm. And it's as if the wolf knows that this person is suffering from a deep trauma, and the shaman would find a animal healer, the wolf becomes that animal healer. Well, I said, now you're around nature. At the end of a week, here's what happened. At the end of the week, 90% of the individuals who attended said that they had transformative experiences.
Yeah.
People said that they had never appreciated how much nature could heal.
Yeah.
And yet it did. And I think that is extremely important. Let me just give you one example. This is, dear Luann, she was one of the facilitators. I hope this finds you well. I'm writing to express my gratitude for allowing my wife and I to have a wonderful wedding anniversary at the beautiful retreat with lots of like-minded and health-conscious people. Mm-hmm. I cannot stop there and must further thank you for allowing our two sons to be exposed to such life-changing information. They're in their 20s. Yeah. This is priceless and will serve as a great foundation for their future. From the bottom of our hearts, we say thank you. Please pass our gratitude to Gary for making this possible in our lives. So in 2 weeks, people had a chance to commune with nature, to get up close and personal. And all those who chose to silence their mind and express an interest in nature came away, some with major healings, all touched. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, you know, Gary, you've got the Celtic blood in you. In the old Celtic world, and I was, as a child, a Brehon ward, I was taught this. The person, a person, is considered to be made of body, mind, and soul. Your body can be hurt, and your mind can be damaged. And if your soul is rendered apart, it's very, very difficult for people. It's PTSD. It's all these things where you're ripped apart and you can't put it together again so easily. But I can imagine somebody going into silence, and you do have to go into silence, because in the ancient culture of Ireland, silence was always healing. And that word, a particular soft silence, was called uncunus. Cunus is the soft silence you can also feel with another person. You can find it in the forest. Sitting alone in the forest, uncunus will come to you. And that was always considered to be a healing of the soul. So if your soul is ruptured, your mind is ruptured, you are not a whole body. And the Irish, the ancient Celts, always considered the whole unit to be looked at holistically, and that's exactly what you're doing right now.
Well, you've been doing it for a long time, Diana, and I hope that you give us a film, because I'd love to do a webinar at an appropriate time, maybe this summer, where we can show the film, and then you and the producer do a webinar afterwards that explains so much to people so they can get even more information on this topic.
You know, Gary, I would be honored, and I'm speaking for Jeff, my director. I know he would be honored, too.
A final little footnote. 4 years ago, I was going to do a cookbook, a vegan cookbook, that also had every food in there would be a healing food. And my agent said that, well, the big houses, they're going to want to print the book in China because it's cheaper. And I said, no, I want to print it in America. I want three times the amount of trees planted. I don't want to use toxic ink. I want vegetable dyes.
Yes.
I want recycled paper. I want it made in America with union labor. And that's exactly what happened. And that man's name is Brian Connolly. Now, Brian's father brought back Celtic to teach in the schools of Ireland, and his father, Brian's grandfather, his father's father, Connolly, was one of the leaders of the revolution, the Irish Revolution, 1917, the male revolution. He was one of the guys that strapped to a chair and shot. So
famous
it was kind
family.
Of a famous family. And, and Brian, the son, who's the publisher of that book, which was, by the way, the number one hit on PBS 3 years ago.
Congratulations.
And I said afterwards, when we were looking at how it was going, and if you open the book, it says, you know, this book was with vegetable dyes and grown up, made in America with recycled paper and all this. And it takes a certain type of person and a certain quality of character to forego profit for principle. And today we need principle over profit.
Yeah.
So thank you, Diana, for all that you're doing.
And it's an honor to talk to you again, and I hope we will do so later on in the summer.
We will. And the book is The Sweetness of a Simple Life and Global Forest. The website for the film is calloftheforest.ca. And my guest, Diana Burchford Kroeger, K-R-O-E-G-E-R. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. I look forward to our next program. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right
on.
Many of you cry. Brother, brother, brother.